Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Well, hello everyone from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio as we reach around the world to our listeners in Australia, Ireland, England, New Zealand, and even a small community of Monrovia, Indiana. It's great to have you along tonight. We've got a wonderful guest joining us in a little bit. Harvey Kubernick has an exciting new book out called Turn Up the Radio, and we'll talk about his it was 50 years ago today the Beatles invade American Hollywood. We'll have a chance to chat about that as well. And, of course, as always, from the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana, now HD, newly renovated and so nicely air-conditioned, the Honorable Distinguished Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Why, good evening, Mr. Batson. What's going on out there at the Batson Wildlife Preserve tonight?
You know, for the last 2 weeks, my life has revolved around baby bottles. We have a brand-new baby Coata Monday.
Sweet.
It's just about as cute as anything can be. It's now almost 3 weeks old.
I agree. They're quite interesting characters.
They're a trip. For our listeners, if you do not know what they are, please Google them. It's Coatimundi, Coata Monday. And we have the Patagonian Cavy, which we've now added to our animal family, which is essentially the second largest rodent in the world, and it's just beyond cool. And our white fox. So we've been, I know when people have children, they say how exhausted they are. I feel the same way. But it's been fun, you know, what the heck. It's still beats having a job, I'll tell you that. And the weather's been absolutely delightful here in Indiana.
Yes, it has.
We're waiting for the big weekend, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the Indianapolis 500. Next week's guest, Mark Chesney, who we call the world's greatest sports fan, will be joining us, and he's flying into Indy this weekend, and we're going to go to the race. He's never seen it before. He's been to some 4,000 sporting events and never been to the Indianapolis 500, so he's in for a dandy, so we're looking forward to that. This weekend, next week he'll be on the show with Pacer expert and member of the Motor Speedway broadcasting team, Mark Monteith. He'll be with us next week on Wild World. And, of course, this part of Wild World is brought to you by ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. Go to the website, ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. Brand new video on demand. It's only $4.99, over 6 hours of video. If you're a fan of such programs as Finding Bigfoot, Sasquatch Legend Meets Science, and some of the other documentaries that have been done on the various channels, 6 hours of speakers and information featuring Bob Gimlin of the infamous Patterson-Gimlin film, Steve Calls, Melissa Hovey, Billy Willard, and yours truly. It's fantastic. And go to their website, ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. They make it possible for Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News for May 22nd. This month is just flying by.
Oh, it is.
Well, it's 67 degrees in Naptown tonight. Quite lovely.
Yes, it is.
We'll take it. We went through some storms earlier in the week, but how'd you survive out there?
The storms were no problem, just a lot of rain. But there was no damaging winds and hail and all the other things they described in other parts of the state.
Yeah, we've got all of
that here.
Yeah.
And God bless, I think it was Oklahoma had a nasty storm move through there. So God bless all of our listeners in that part of the country.
Just some bad weather.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you're headed to Florida over the Memorial Weekend, beware. Audubon, Florida, and the Gulf Islands National Seashore officials are taking extra measures to protect mating and nesting coastal birds as tens of thousands of visitors hit the beaches this weekend for the Memorial Day holiday.
Good.
So if you're headed out, the wildlife officials will be watching you.
Of course
all
they
right.
will.
Here's some exciting news from Denver, Colorado. The Denver Zoo is welcoming a new female clouded leopard cub.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
I want
quite a beautiful animal.
Yeah.
Now, the cub was born April 10th at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute in Fort Royal, Virginia.
Mm.
And now you can see it at the Denver Zoo.
Great.
All right, it's safe to go downtown in Danville, Kentucky. A hive of honeybees has been safely removed from the downtown area after trapping customers in a store on Monday.
I heard about that.
Yes. Now, I don't know if it was a coincidence or not, but the store was Honey R Us.
Really?
All right, Los Angeles, California. Ooh, what's that smell? What's that smell?
Yeah.
Well, lack of oxygen caused the deaths of tens of thousands of fish that likely sought shelter there in the harbor.
Mm.
Now, scientists suspect that the school of northern anchovies may have sought cover from a predator near Marina Del Rey on Saturday. Now, workers have removed more than 6 tons of anchovies.
Oh, my.
Yeah, that's one hell of a pizza.
Oh, God. Or more than one.
Yeah, 6 tons of anchovies.
Yeah.
All right, now here's a true pearl of the sea. Key Biscayne, Florida, a rehabilitated green sea turtle, has been returned to the wild off of Florida's east coast.
Mm.
Now, pearl was found in December in Bal Harbor area, dehydrated, lethargic, and covered with parasites.
Yuck.
Yeah, now the turtle was taken to the Marine Sea Aquarium in Miami, where it was recovered and released over the weekend.
Well, good for them. That's
good for
fantastic.
Pearl. Always like to hear that people helping out.
Yeah, we
all
like
right,
positive
well,
stories.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with this adventure. Montpelier, Vermont. Yes, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is working with a town in Quebec to prevent sea lamprey from traveling up a tributary of Lake Champlain just north of the Vermont border.
Hmm.
Yeah, now they're going to try to prevent the lampreys from traveling up the lake, the river there.
Yeah. Those are nasty. They inundated the Great Lakes and did terrible things to
the
population. Nasty, nasty.
Right.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, that's what I say, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we want to say thank you to a good Samaritan in Prior Lake, Minnesota. Now, a landscaper was driving along the highway when he discovered a fawn. Its mother had been killed by a vehicle. Well, he stopped to help the doe, but she was already dead. But he did help deliver the fawn, which was turned over to the wildlife officials, yes.
I remember a story like that years ago. Well, good for a while.
Yep. We were involved with one of those, with a story pretty similar to this.
Yeah, I remember that.
All right. Now, what's going on in Fairlawn, New Jersey? Well, they're going to be able to paint their water tower now. Yeah, the town is free to resume painting its water tower after a pair of nesting ravens has flown away.
Oh.
Yeah, now active raven nests are protected by federal and state laws.
Mm-hmm. They are.
So they had to put off painting their water tower for a while. And when I see a water tower, I want it painted black.
Well, you know, the only time you can ever do anything to a bird like that is if they're in the act of damaging an ornamental tree. And besides that, they're federally protected. A lot of people don't realize that, but they are.
Ravens.
Yeah.
I always wanted to have a raven, own a raven,
yeah,
or a crow, but that's against the law. So
yeah, right.
Can't do it. All right, well, you don't mess with Mother Nature, and you don't mess with wildlife officials. Reno, Nevada. A mother and daughter have been convicted of tampering with a bear trap at Lake Tahoe to thwart wildlife officials' efforts to capture the animal. Now, it's the first case that was that's been prosecuted in Nevada. Now, we don't want to mention any names, but Cheryl Ann Morrison, 63, and her daughter, Susan Morrison, 35, each faced up to $3,000 in fines.
Oh, my.
For, tripping the set wire on the bear trap.
Oh, hell. That's not fair.
Now, you know, the reason why they're trapping is they're trying to help the animals.
Yeah.
And well, you just can't do that.
You know, some people just don't get it. They just don't get it. No.
All right. In other news, Jackson Hole, Wyoming, an auction of antlers that benefits a national elk refuge and the local Boy Scouts has netted more than $23,000, which is about three times what they normally average in the antler auction.
I wonder what Dave Davies would say about that.
Larry, you know.
Yeah, Dave.
you know the Woody Allen movie, Everything You Want to Know About Sex?
Yeah.
Well, that was a story about some horny Boy Scouts.
Oh, sometimes. No.
All right, I'm in the middle on this next story, Grand Coulee, Washington. The Grand Coulee Dam. Now, every year people get together for a big celebration on Memorial Day. Now, some people will miss the Soaring Eagle and Neil Diamond singing America.
Neil who?
Yes. Yeah, now others will be glad to see him go. Now, after 25 years of Neil Diamond singing America, the dam's laser light show will be replaced with a new laser light show, which is scheduled to debut this weekend on Saturday.
Yeah,
it's kind of sad. Now, I love Neil, and Neil always said he was a songwriter, not a singer, but we appreciate
Well, he's a wonderful singer.
He's entertained us all these years.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
All
Harvey
right.
probably even knows
well,
Neil Diamond.
Are you ready to play Who's Gotten Older this last week?
Okay. Yes, I'm ready.
All right, Harvey, are you ready to play?
I sure am.
All right, I want you to tell me, how old do you believe musician Pete Townsend is?
Pete Townsend would be 71.
Mr. Batson?
I'll say 69.
Oh, right on the money. Pete turned 69 this week.
Okay.
Damn, I never get him right.
Yeah, all right. Now, singer, bassist Dusty Hill of ZZ Top.
Oh, that's hard to say.
68.
I'll say 70.
He turned 65 this week.
Oh,
all right, now, singer, actress, model, Grace Jones.
Oh, my.
Grace Jones is 63.
I'll go a little older. I'll say 66.
Nope. Harvey was right there on the edge. Grace turned 62 this week.
Wow. Just like me.
All right. How old do you think Joe Cocker is?
Oh, no.
Joe Cocker is 71.
I'm not even going to guess on that one.
Boy, Harvey's right on the edge again. Joe turned 70 this week.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
All right. How about Cher?
Cher is 69.
I'll say 65. I'm way off.
Cher turned 68 this week. Mm-hmm. Harvey is right on.
Yeah,
the
but you have to say I take a Buddhist situation where you're a year older because it's where you start.
See, there you go.
I add the 9 months up front.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
All right. Now, try to pull this one out. Okay. Susan Cowsill of the Cowsills.
Okay. She is 58.
61.
We both were a little off. She turned 65.
Wow.
Yeah.
All
right. Ron Isley of the Isley Brothers.
Oh,
he is 73.
I'll say 70.
No.
Oh,
Harvey's right on it. Wrong. Harvey got this one right, 73.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm better than that.
All right, no, Leo Sayer.
Leo Sayer is 65.
I'll agree with Harvey.
66.
Okay.
Wow. Okay.
All right. Our last Who Got Older This Week guest tonight is Bernie Taupin.
Mm-hmm. Bernie Taupin is 66.
Oh, I thought you had it, Harvey.
Yeah.
Mr. Batson?
I'll say 65.
64.
Oh God. When I'm 64. Okay.
All right. It's time for the Wild World Facts.
Okay. We're ready. I'm sitting down.
Well, wait a minute. I think I'll do the biggest news story of the week. Have you heard about the world's largest dinosaur?
A little bit about it. Not much.
Well, paleontologists have unearthed a creature that is so big it dwarfs everything else that walked on land. It was 65 feet tall, weighed 77 tons, and it was 65 foot is equal to like a 7-story building. It weighed as much as 14 African elephants. Now there's a photo that goes with one of the paleontologists is laying next to the femur, which is a leg bone, and it looks like he's laying next to a canoe.
Oh, God.
That's how big the bone was.
That's impressive.
They found like 150 other fossils of different animals with this, what they're calling the Titanosaurus. So there were other predators. They believe they got stuck in a mud bog. But anyway, that's the big news of the week. All right, let's get on with this. We want to get Harvey on. We're running a little long.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're doing, since we got a big race in town this weekend, we're doing Indianapolis 500 Facts. Now, Churchill Downs, Yankee Stadium, the Rose Bowl, the Roman Coliseum, and Vatican City could all fit inside the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Oval.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. Now, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is the world's largest spectator sporting facility, with more than 250,000 permanent seats.
I'll be using one of them.
I have a question to ask. Have they ever, over the decades, had any rock and roll festivals or shows there?
Sammy Hagar is going to play there this weekend on what they call Carburation Day, which is tomorrow. Last year they had Bret Michaels. And yeah, they've over the years, and of course Steven Tyler got in trouble because when he sang the national anthem before the race, he changed the lyrics a little bit. So
yeah,
I'll be quiet before showtime. So not a problem.
All right, now the first event at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway was a helium gas filled balloon competition on Saturday, June the 5th, 1909. And just 2 months later, the Oval was completed.
Yeah. It's quite impressive.
Since Memorial Day is closing in on us, Memorial Day was originally honored military personnel who died in the Civil War, which was 1861 to 1865. But the holiday now honors those who died in any war while serving with the United States.
God bless every one of them.
That's right. And that's the Wild World News for May 22nd.
Once again, a great job done by Dr. Henry Day and his staff at the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana. HD, newly renovated. In fact, he even has new paneling in his studio, so it's quite impressive. We want to remind everyone to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. Tells all about our wildlife rescue work that we do, also our wildlife education programs that are available to schools and various organizations all across the country. And our wonderful Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, that tells all about our recent goings-on. I mean, if you join the Facebook page, you'll know about where we're appearing. Also, great animal videos and so forth. And, hey, as always, make it possible for Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio. Couple of weeks, Turn Up the Radio, the history of radio in L.A. in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Our guest tonight, Harvey Kubernick. Good evening, Harvey.
Good evening, Larry.
Great to have you on the show.
Always a pleasure to talk to somebody in Indiana.
The way you said that,
well, you know, you do know I was a Rick Mount basketball fan, you know, and
we liked the
ABA team that was in Indiana too.
Well, the Pacers, yes.
Well, you know, I worked with John Wooden. I mean, he went to, you know, he went to Purdue. So, need I say anything else?
No, you need not. It's a pleasure to have fans from that part of the country. And I have to tell you, you've been on the show, and we've talked about A Perfect Haze, the Illustrated History of the Monterey International Pop Festival, which is a phenomenal piece of work.
Yes,
and also what I've considered to be kind of the Liverpool of the U.S. and in the music world, the Canyon of Dreams, the magic and music of Laurel Canyon. But this new book, Harvey, Turn Up the Radio, Rock, Pop, and Roll in Los Angeles, 1956 to 1972. This is phenomenal. My God.
Thank you for the praise. You're probably going to say, how long did it take you to do it? And I don't have a standard answer, but I will tell you. It's like saying, how long have you done radio? And though, even though it might be 5, 10, or 15 years, it starts when you're about 6.
Yeah.
And so, honestly, if I was to tell you the first interview that I used partially in this book was done in 1975, so it really was 38, 39 years of stringing this together. I mean, yes, 2.5, 3 years I've been assembling and working and writing the book, but I had archive and interviews that stretch back to 1975.
Well, it is phenomenal. Not only the interviews, the photographs, the whole packaging. It's a table book, folks, and I'm telling you, I've had it for almost 3 weeks, and I just start someplace in the book and start reading, and it's just phenomenal. That's all I can say. Just phenomenal.
Well, you know, my friend Kirk Silsby, a writer and a music historian, says every page brings you to a new door.
Well, it does, and for folks our age, this brings back so many wonderful memories, and you go into depth on how some of these recordings were put together and how they were promoted on radio. I mean, it's just, I don't know where to begin.
Neither do I, but I do think the book proves thousands of little things. There's secret tunnels in this book that connect all of us, but I do know one thing that's really obvious. I do think the book proves or underscores or reiterates or demonstrates just how many fantastic records were developed, born, raised, recorded, produced, released, or introduced on the airwaves of Los Angeles and Hollywood that stretched across the United States and subsequently went around the world. And I don't think another book has truly ever, put that kind of journey together. And I know, I try to distance myself from this book right now since I'm in the middle of some sort of, promotional tour, and I'm being asked constantly on radio and long-form interviews and podcasts and FM and about the book with people that are disc jockeys or air personalities. It's probably the first time somebody gave long-form kudos to the disc jockeys and the people that played the plastic, records. Because
sure.
You had the disc jockey was the messenger or the vehicle where we first heard some of this stuff. And I don't think the disc jockeys and the Los Angeles tastemakers of the last 50 and 60 years ever really have gotten their due in the documentation of rock and pop and roll music, so I decided to do it.
Well, that is so true because the radio is what powers these musicians and these recordings that they come up with, and without radio, now with internet radio, it's just expanded the amount of promotion that can be done. But in that era, it was so special to hear the singles for the first time. You know, we played the Byrds. And when I was reading about that, and I kind of got a chuckle because if my memory is correct, David Crosby was totally against the Byrds recording Mr. Tambourine Man.
He initially voted against it in a group meeting. He later changed his mind. A few of the members of the Byrds each took turns at doing the lead vocal, and then Jim McGuinn, later Roger McGuinn, stepped up to the plate. And it's really one of the few tracks that there are session musicians augmenting Roger McGuinn's vocal and guitar playing on the record.
Mm-hmm.
But also I make it a point to kind of show the role of the session man and women out in L.A., on these recordings, how they helped a lot of the initial groups get their, sea legs together in the recording studio. And then, the training wheels came off the bike. And here we are talking about these records 30, 40, and 50 years later. And I always knew the music of L.A. had durability and longevity. I knew it wasn't a plastic town. It wasn't a phony town. And remember, my references are 1956 to 1972. My feelings about my hometown have changed dramatically this century. But I'm looking at a period piece, and I really think, the music from this place. Well, I mentioned in the prologue or the epilogue or in an interview with the producer-engineer Bones how this is where the future began. and so much technology was introduced here and recording studio innovations and so many natives and people coming to this town to find a new life as a communicator or a musician or whatever. Mm-hmm. It all seemed to come from this place because Hollywood is a magnet, or Television City, as CBS TV was sort of called. Everybody wanted to come here. I have a very skewed view of this whole trip because I'm born and raised in Hollywood in Los Angeles. I didn't have to come here and reinvent myself, change my name, lower my age, stab everybody to make it, scam everybody. I was already in Hollywood in the incubator looking out a window overlooking the Hollywood 101 freeway. So I didn't have to go find myself in Hollywood and make it. You know what I mean? And very rarely do natives, and I'm talking about native Angelenos, very rarely do we really have a chance to tell the truth about this town, much like, you know, Chumash Indians or any kind of Indian literature. How often have they initially in movies before literature ever had a chance to write their own scripts or do their own movies or TV shows and show a native, and I'm talking American Indian, how often have they had access to tell their side of the slaughter, you know? So I just, destiny or something, you know, led me to this path on this one. And I was, I'm very happy with this book because it truly took decades. I had a lot of support doing this book. I had some alignments with some fantastic friends of mine who, gave me access to their archives. But I've always been doing interviews and I've always been writing. And to tell you the truth, a lot of this stuff was written when there was no book deal or no destination in sight. I write every day, even if there's a market or an editor or a magazine, even if it doesn't, leave me. I've been writing every day since 1972. So now the stuff's starting to come out in very big vision, products. A lot of hard work.
Well, it is. I mean, it's just mind-boggling when you leaf through it. And some of the artists, and the connections of the various artists on different recordings. Like, I didn't realize really how big and well-known Ian Whitcomb was in L.A. and how much he was involved with different things.
And you see, it means a lot for you to tell me this, not because he's, a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen him slighted in some previous rock and roll paperback books or some, and I don't do Facebook or any of that stuff, but recently there were a few untrue things said about him where he was sort of dismissed as a one-hit wonder. Nothing could be so further from the truth that I decided to make him a reoccurring voice or a theme through the book. Yes, he had a bunch of, maybe he's had 20 albums out, probably written 8 or 9 books, including a monumental book called After the Ball, hosted television shows in England and Europe around the world, played with Big J. McNeely, was on Shindig, to this day still hosts an internet radio show. So like all of us, because we don't have that New York cred, people tend to dismiss some of us, or people like Ian, who, by the way, is an American citizen now.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it a point in this book, partially because he had an archive of himself on all the teen dance programs in Los Angeles, some of which I danced on, and some of which he always took photos with disc jockeys like, Casey Kasem and Lloyd Thaxton. I made it a point to put him on equal footing with, the Beach Boys and the Birds and the Doors and things like that. And he was also a chapter in my previous book, Canyon of Dreams, because for a brief time he was a Laurel Canyon dweller. And he really is a music historian and a ukulele player and a piano player. And, he's played around the world. So when people like you or a reader actually invest the time to get into this new book,
mm-hmm.
You realize I kind of know who Ian Whitcomb is. You Turn Me On, nice song, Tower Records. I think
right.
I saw him, you know, on the Johnny Carson show 30 years ago. Mm. And you don't have to push the button on the computer. I lay out his credits, and then you realize, I thought I kind of knew some of this stuff. Harvey has given us 18 different bits of new information about this guy. And then all of a sudden, you're basically like, you know, silent for a minute or two because you're stunned by what's been revealed.
Yeah. It's so exciting.
Why isn't he cocky tonight? But you know, it means a lot when you pick up on people like Ian because he's a thread through the book. I start the book with him because he did BBC documentaries about the early Los Angeles R&B world, and he was gracious to give me tapes of like interviews with Johnny Otis and people like that, and point out record labels that started in the 20s in Culver City. We do have a history of R&B or blues and rhythm in this town. Unfortunately, the mass media, the literary world, and the rock and roll community has very rarely let Los Angeles's roots be shown.
Yeah. Well, it's... And there was something else, too, that I was quite impressed with on this book. I'm going to be going back and forth with it a lot. And as you know, I'm a tremendous Beatles fan. And when you brought up the name of Dave Hall as the fifth Beatle, that was intriguing because that is so important to the promotion of, I don't care who the band is, of when someone picks up on like that And he says, we played the Stones, we went heavy on Satisfaction, became number one worldwide, especially in this country. Helped promote Bob Eubanks when he brought the Beatles to the Hollywood Bowl and then at Dodger
mm-hmm.
Stadium in 1966. And how these stations like KRLA are so important to these people don't realize. The Rolling Stones, the Beatles, whomever, they would have been zero if it wasn't the support of these stations like in L.A. and New York, of course, and the central part of the country just doesn't really play into the game at all as far as these artists and their success.
Well, you know, the book shows, and remember, both of us, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners, and, you know, when I'm involved in media now, I mean, like the link for your radio show,
mm-hmm.
This appearance I'm doing, it's just not a little chat between you and I.
Mm-hmm.
I think you know when you see the, whatever you want to call it, the journey of Harvey Kubernick, this thing is like gone global. You know,
oh,
and I think what's I'm really happy for one really big reason that I get to remind people about the glory of AM radio and the AM radio dial and the Boss radio format and a world before FM radio or internet or downloading. We really had to work hard to find the music, didn't we?
Well, we did. And what was the beauty of the stations in that era in the 60s, at least here in Indianapolis, was our most popular station was an AM called WIFE, the Wife Good Guys.
Mm-hmm.
But they played it all. They played the soul music of the Jacksons, the Temptations. They played the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and they would even play country music if it was popular and current. So you got a complete variety. I mean, now it's you know, you won't hear Michael Jackson next to whomever, Bruno Mars, or you
mm-hmm.
know, it's not like it.
Well, I always say that AM radio, where I grew up, and of course you as well, was a very integrated neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have very segregated neighborhoods as far as the radio dial,
yes,
and
we have a
disenfranchised, you know, not listenership, but just things are so, you know, it's like a Chinese restaurant menu. Here's your, you know, water. Here's your protein. I mean, it's so columned out. you could hear back then novelty records with you know, Pat Boone, with Satisfaction, with Roger Miller. And because, you know, I mean, rock and roll wasn't that big of a business back then, and the radio consultants weren't calling all the shots then, and we were all in this secret little club together. That's why you and I have the commonality or the connectivity of kind of knowing each other, even though we've never really met and talked a few times on the phone, although it happens to be broadcast to probably hundreds of thousands of people. But but the thing is, the music was the glue that introduced us to the path we're on. And I truly believe I'm, you know, if it sounds like, you know, Hollywood corny stuff, I'm sorry, that's just the way it's gone down. And so I think the book really shows just how important, and correct me if I'm wrong, as you thumb through the book, and by the way, people like look at a page or two, go back to it in a week. I mean, it would take you a full week to read the book and digest it. And by the way, you remember one thing, and I contend this happened with the Canyon of Dreams book, and there, and I think it happened with the Monterey Pop book that I did with my brother Kenneth. You're never the same after you read one of the books I do.
You really
aren't, and I'm really happy about that, because what happens is that the books dispel a large percentage of the envy, jealousy, hatred, worship of Los Angeles and Hollywood, or the dismissal of Hollywood that people tend to build up as kind of going, oh, whatever this place is. No, there are real people out here who created music that changed your life.
Yes.
And this book reminds us of that, but then introduces us to hundreds of little facts. And you can't get this from the internet or anywhere. You actually had to live the life that was given to me to hear the music on the radio, or to meet these bands, or to see these concerts. I mean, do I blame it on my parents? They're the ones that chose, well, they were here in the 40s. They, you know, I said to my mother only a few years ago, because my parents, I mean, thank God, my mother's 90, my dad will be 92 soon. I mean, they're
God
still
bless.
With me. I mean, my dad's a little feeble, and he's in a home, but, I mean, we talk and we visit, and my mother's still driving and that kind of stuff. I've been making sure to talk to him and her about things, because, I mean, they're on the planet to see this, a little bit of an appreciation of the work I'm doing. But I said to her, my mother, I said, could you explain why I was born in this Catholic hospital, Queen of Angels, on the border of East Hollywood and Los Angeles, which truly does overlook the Hollywood 101 freeway?
Yeah.
And I said, like, I mean, you lived in downtown L.A. Why are you kind of, you know, why am I being delivered in Hollywood or Echo Park? You know, I mean, you know, we're blocks away from it.
Right.
And she said, I don't know what you're talking about. That's where my gynecologist was located. The older we get, and this is something Andrew Luke Oldham, who's a disc jockey on weekends on Sirius XM, Little Stevens Underground Garage, and people might know, as a former producer-manager, you know, of the Rolling Stones, and one of the leading lights in rock and roll history.
Yes.
He told me there are no coincidences, and things happen for a reason, and I've gone into full acceptance of being, you know, the messenger. But also, I think I'm correcting, you know, let's just say I'm like the contact lens to put a clear vision on how people look at my hometown, because you never will look at Hollywood or L.A. again after you read this book. It's really impossible, because this town and the people and the musicians and the music and the recording studios and the television shows in this period of 1956 to 1972, whether you want to cop to it or not, really made a much bigger impact on your life than you even realize.
Absolutely. And moments ago when you were talking about how things intertwine and come together, I was it just so happens I was looking here with Andrew Luke Oldham, and how Mick and Keith Richards, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, met the first time, because I believe it was Mick that was carrying a stack of vinyl Chess records.
And they met at like a bus stop in, you know, the London area.
And Keith noticed them and said, wow, look at
what. Yeah, Chuck Berry was one of the records, yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and later on they would end up recording in Chess studios. I mean.
Something that Andrew Lou Goldham helped engineer as the producer and manager of the band. And that's, you know, that's important because they got invested in the music of America.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up at Chess Records. And again, as I made this book, part of a family Kubernik journey. My parents, you know, are from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to show the Chicago entry of them and the Stones and Andrew and Marshall Chess, who I interviewed for the book, and kind of show the, maybe we'll call it the antecedent root, if that's the term, and how, it winds from Chicago to L.A., as the Bobby Troup Route 66 song goes. And I will tell you, you know, how lucky we all are that Andrew steered the Rolling Stones to Hollywood and Sunset Boulevard and literally produced just about every session and every album that the Rolling Stones did from 1964 to 1967 in Hollywood.
Yes.
And as I wrote in Andrew Lou Goldham's memoir, Too Stoned, where he asked me to be a guest vocalist and write a mini chapter in the book,
mm-hmm.
And I was just so thrilled to be asked to do that. I mean, I'm a guy, you know, who ends up meeting like the Rolling Stones and Andrew. These were not even dreams I ever had, but that's a whole other story. If you think I ever dreamed of being a writer or an author, you're out of your mind. But I know one thing. I did write in Andrew's book, and I got a lot of kudos for this and then a lot of hissy fits from some people where I meet at signings, although they liked what I wrote. I wrote in Andrew's book, Too Stoned, many years ago, about the Stones recording in Hollywood with Jack Nitzsche and people like that. I shudder to think if these records were recorded in New York.
Yeah.
And so I believe environment plays a big part of recording. Location informs the recordings.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think a Rolling Stones album, 64 to 67, would be better if they were done in New York or in Chicago or in Philadelphia, I think they turned out just the way they were supposed to be in Hollywood.
I think you're right. And to me, to this day, even still, the best Stones records were from 1964 to 1967.
The studio, and I point out in the book, the studio RCA Records had something to do with it, and the engineers like Dave Hassinger and Al Schmidt before him. The Rolling Stones walked into a room at RCA Studios that Duke Ellington had recorded in, Sam Cooke had recorded, Henry Mancini had done recordings there. Later, the Monkees, the Electric Prunes, the Jefferson Airplane, all recorded there. So, and that's not even counting Elvis Presley was, you know, on RCA Records and used that room.
Yeah.
So the studio, due to the layout and due to the logistics and due to their microphone,
mm-hmm.
you know, collection, all these little factors as we trap sound inform the records that are made.
Yep.
And then you have all these wonderful people like J.W. Alexander, who was Sam Cooke's manager for a while and worked with him, you know, on the road, or
mm-hmm.
Jack Nitzsche arranging and playing on Rolling Stones records. So you had L.A. historic figures adding, you know, to the big, thick, you know, stew of sound. And that's why those records just sound so good. And I had to bring in, even though it's a book about Los Angeles, rock, pop, and roll, 1956 to 1972, I brought in people like the Stones who used the recording facilities in town and played live, and that I saw, you know, perform in the late 60s, because I just couldn't separate And in my radio dial, I mean, you know, on KHJ or RKO radio stations, or KRLA or KFWB, you know, our non-Bill Drake consulted stations, the Rolling Stones records were played right next to Frank and Nancy Sinatra,
yep,
or the Electric Prunes and all that. And so I just could not excommunicate them from this text.
No, absolutely not. No, it's just fantastic. We have to take a short break. We're going to be back with Harvey Kubernick in just a couple moments. You're listening to Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. This is Larry Batson. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
How am I sounding?
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny! Playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters?
It's Bobcat, Abby. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean?
Oh, not.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland-urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website, and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
We're Rascal Flats. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
We'll be back with Harvey Kubernick in just a moment. We want to remind everyone that this part of Wild World is brought to you by McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful, scenic Estes Park, Colorado, on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. If you've never had the opportunity to visit that part of the country, folks, it is absolutely spiritual. It's quite beautiful. McGregor Mountain Lodge, that's the place to stay. And it borders Rocky Mountain National Park. You'll have bighorn sheep and elk within just feet of your cabin, and it's absolutely spectacular. And they have a 24-hour webcam, which you can observe. Go to the website, McGregor Mountain Lodge, blogtalkradio.com, and we do appreciate them for helping make it possible for Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio. We want to remind everyone, be sure you check out our archives for all of our past programs. Lots of different shows with artists like Rick Derringer, Dave Davies of the Kinks, Al Jardine of the Beach Boys. Gosh, where does it end? Tony Kaye of Yes, Chris France from Talking Heads, Jimmy Greenspoon from Three Dog Night, Rodney Justo just on from Atlanta Rhythm Section. It's all there in our archives at Blog Talk Radio. Just Google Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. And I have to tell you, Harvey, when I hear that song by the Beach Boys, it brings back the memories of transistor radios, which were so important to our culture. And having one on my bicycle as I drove through our West Side Indianapolis neighborhood and listening to the Beach Boys play I Get Around. I mean, that just...
Well, you know, you're talking to a guy that, A, not only saw them perform in 1962 in Culver City, California, sort of a neighboring suburb to, like, Hawthorne, where they, you know, where they came from. Mm-hmm. But I address in the book, and I've been doing this in interviews, especially when I talk to, you know, disc jockeys, the role of the transistor radio in, what, 1959, 60, 61, 62, 63, it helped transport the new teen music. And the advertising, whether it be Coppertone or Prel shampoo, with it. And for younger listeners to our broadcast tonight, it truly was even more profound and more potent than, you know, a Walkman or walking around, you know, with headphones and pushing buttons on your iPod, simply because up until the transistor radio, we heard things on the car radio, but we heard things largely in our bedrooms or our parents' radio. The mobile device, including, you know, headsets and all that, that stuff did not exist in the 50s.
No.
And going into the early 60s. You know what I'm talking about. So,
sure.
So when you could have the freedom of a paper route or a bike going to school or a skateboard, in my case, you had a transistor radio in your pocket or on your wrist, and you got to hear a music away from the confines of your own home, let alone the supervision of your parents.
Yeah.
And also, so the discovery was pretty deep.
Well, it was. And you know, one of the first artists to really, they were fascinated with the transistor radio when they were given them on their first trip to America. And you know who I'm talking about.
Well, I think our friends got some of those when they arrived in New York City, if my memory serves me well.
Yes.
Our friends, the Beatles.
The Beatles. In fact, in the documentary, The Beatles Come to America.
Oh, I love that documentary. I interviewed Albert Mayslis, who did that with his brother.
Oh, it's and they've got those transistor radios. with the earplugs in their ears, like from the airport to the hotel. And I think finally George listened to it so much, Paul finally went off on him and said before the
That's a very good point. It's a very good point about the transistor radio and the transportation of the music out here. But the other thing is, I knew the Beach Boys were, you know, important, not because I'm in 9, 10, and 11 discovering them for the first time. And, I did surf a little bit. I did live kind of in a coastal community in the late 50s and early 60s. I mean, 3.5 miles maybe from the beach. I'm talking the West Coast Pacific Ocean. But, you know, I always find it amazing now how much beach music or car culture music or water music, in the case of the Beach Boys' first few albums, what kind of impact it made in worlds like you, 2,000 miles away from the water.
Right.
But then again, the Endless Summer movie was debuted in Idaho before it played on the West Coast. And let's face it, car songs or car culture music like I Get Around is certainly going to connect with cats like you in Indiana, considering you've got the Indianapolis 500 and you know, a car that. But surf music made a big impact across the United States, and therefore maybe the imagery of the water and the surfboard and surfer girl was secondary to the beautiful vocals or the production of the music, you know.
And what marketing experts they were. Think about it. They lived in Southern, but they didn't surf.
Only Dennis Wilson did.
Yeah, they were just aware of the culture, and they knew the type of music that they needed to produce to become a hit, essentially.
Yes, and, you know, it took people like the wonderful A&R man producer Nick Vinay, who heard their earlier recordings of the Beach Boys and signed them to Capitol Records and produced maybe their first two albums. So, I think the book kind of shows, I mean, if people think we've read enough about Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, I suggest they take a read of one of the chapters in my book and hear what people say about Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, or take a look at some of the visuals, which you've never seen. And you may learn something about the Beach Boys that might make you listen to their catalog a little different or longer next time you get the itch.
Well, I found intriguing, and correct me if I'm wrong, that he would record different parts of the music in different studios because of the different sounds. For instance, woodwinds or strings or a harpsichord would get.
Well, you know, I know Brian from, you know, 6 or 8 interviews over 40 years, and I've been in the studio with him and been to his various houses, and, you know, I know this guy, and I've talked a lot about recording with him. You know, writing like interviews for his like 2007 tour book and, you know, things like that. And he had the luxury and the clout. He did something that I think benefits many record artists, you know, years later. He was signed to Capitol Records and did some of the first records there in 62 or 63 there at the Capitol Studios, which were certainly good enough for people like Bobby Darin, Gene Vincent, and Frank Sinatra.
Sure.
Brian didn't like the echo chamber, or chambers plural, at the Capitol Records Studios. And so he wanted to go to some of the other studios like Gold Star, where Phil Spector was present, or United Western or Western Recording, and try other echo techniques. And then he liked some studios for the tack piano, and he had the clout as a hit maker early, and the record label support of people like Nick Vinay and A&R, that he actually was able to transport himself and his band to neighboring studios near Capitol Records, where he wasn't under the eye of the, I would never call it corporate label then, they weren't corporate then, but
no.
He recorded away from the, shall we say, the campus. And I think we got a different of experimental music by him doing that, because, I mean, I'm so acutely tuned in to the engineers and the studios of this town, I could hear a record and tell you what room it was done in. I mean, just
wow.
Because I've logged hundreds of hours in studios doing interviews with engineers, and understand, Altec speakers or the consoles and stuff like that. I mean, I've written a couple of articles for Mix Magazine. I mean, I focused on the technical aspect very early in the music journalism stuff that I was given to. Not like I was some super genius. Nobody liked to ever talk to the engineers. They were always strung out on the lead singers or the girl singer in the band. You know what I'm talking about. So I went and talked to the engineers or the second engineer and wanted to know about equipment and microphone placements and diagonal mics and the difference of a cement floor and a wooden floor and what carpet on the floor did. And so, and I'm only talking about records and, a few dozen bands that were recording in L.A. that I can do this with. Although I won a few bets recently when I heard a few records done in New York and I guessed the name of the studio. And I actually went a couple of dinners on some friends and they started – people. That's the nice thing about, doing a lot of books and it's all kind of connecting with people.
Right.
Now when I win all the trivia contests, I tell everybody, it's going to cost you a meal. So Brian Wilson, I think we have a better understanding of Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys after you read my book, simply because I think, well, I have interviews with Brian talking about individual recordings, don't I? And even though you've heard Please Let Me Wonder and Dance, 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 and I Get Around and Fun, 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 even though you've heard it 2,000 times and many of your listeners have heard these songs,
mm-hmm.
I think I brought some new information to the table.
Well, you have, and it's like I wasn't aware of what I just said, that he went to different studios to record different parts of the songs. I knew they used a lot of studio musicians in the Beach Boys, but I get the feeling with Brian Wilson, the moment he stepped into a studio, he became a different person.
Well, Brian was unhappy at home. Brian needed. Brian is still childlike. He doesn't have to do a lot of the due to management or marriages or early chart success. I'm just trying to put this in a window that everybody may grasp it. But you see, he doesn't have to. Well, I always say I know Paul McCartney doesn't go to FedEx Kinko to mail a package out. You know what I mean? Brian doesn't have to deal, either with the media or publishing houses or music administrators like some of us have to do to advance the art we want to do. People do it for him.
Yeah.
And either through circumstance or economics, that's what's placed for him. And so when he goes into a studio, it's where he's really happy. He likes having a nice meal, don't kid yourself.
Right.
But he likes making music. He likes singing songs. And it's somebody who worked so hard from 1960 to maybe 1980, a 20-year window, that 20-year window that he did a lot of his best music by himself or with collaborators or with the group, completely has influenced so many other people that have made records after hearing his stuff. I mean, his place in history is secure, believe me. But the songs sonically, and I like to think my book adds a little bit on how we should perceive the sonic aspects of the Beach Boys music, much like the sonic aspects of everybody in the book I discuss. And I think it's not a technical book. It's anecdotal, it's narrative, it's oral history. But I think personally,
mm-hmm.
I think people will never be the same again after they digest this book. And I know for sure you'll never listen to music the same way again, ever.
No.
Ever. It's just, there's been too many hundreds of people coming up to me before this book came out saying, I never knew, or I'm now listening to this thing on mono, and in the process of my, you know, expedition, I think I unlocked some doors in some reactive mind situations that even guys like you who are on the radio, you know, playing music and have been disc jockeys, and not to put you in any kind of plateau above a consumer or a listener, but somebody
sure.
like you who wears headphones and listens to music and tracks things on the radio, I think, you know, you may never be the same as far as the appreciation and the understanding and the clarity you get that this book truly offers.
And I have the feeling that what you said is all true, that in the 60s, we were not aware of the genius, the true genius of Brian Wilson.
A handful of people did. The appreciation came later. But, you know, he wasn't a scruffy guy from England with long hair and different clothes. He was rather normal looking.
Yeah.
He didn't have to take the abuse rock and roll musicians with long hair and a different wardrobe took. And he had the security of a family in a brother-based, you know, singing group with a cousin. And the records just hold up quite well. But, you know, in relationship to your show that I'm talking on,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't come as any surprise to you that I, you know, spend a little time visiting the catalogs of Gary Lewis and the Playboys, or Paul Revere and the Raiders, or Al Jardine and the Beach Boys. And you realize that this music of Los Angeles, you see, we live in such an East Coast media-biased society at the moment and you see it in sports, you see it in coverage, you see it in, you see it in voting for most valuable players in sports, you see it in the West Coast is always denigrated, jokes, part of it is sadly the perception of reality TV and things like that, you know, coming from here. But if you dig deep, you realize there's very committed and serious artists here that work very, very hard. And if you take it back 30, 40, and 50 years, you realize just how good the music is by the Association or the Turtles or Three Dog Night, and especially the Monkees, who I chose to feature in the book. And I'm getting a lot of you know, I like when kids come up to me and go, you know, I kind of like the Monkees, but after checking your book out, I went and bought the first three records of them. So, you know, if I'm turning people on to music,
people are
going out buying albums, and by the way, I don't share in the revenue stream of them buying albums or downloading or doing
right.
MP3s or buying box sets. My appreciation is when somebody like Danny Hutton at Three Dog Night told me, you know, He goes on tour a lot on the weekends with Three Dog Night, and he says, man,
yep.
people bring your book up to me all the time. And I think it's just great if he's in Arizona or Indianapolis or Atlanta, Florida or something,
mm-hmm.
and at a state fair or Disney World or something like that. And he's signing, like, my Canyon of Dreams book. I mean, I like knowing that sort of stuff because I know the virus is spreading.
Yes. And,
but it's
and
a good
had,
it's a good virus, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm one of the people that I want to know more about these recordings that we grew up with. And when we have these artists on the show, I personally thank them for working so hard and putting out such great material and such great music for the background of our lives, because people have no concept of how hard of work that these artists do. Shelley Leibowitz was on, who's very close with the Rolling Stones, says, those boys work their tails off when they were, I mean, and Al Jardine, when he was on the program, he said the same thing. He says, it's a very, very hard job. It's a lot of work. And Dave Davies from the Kinks, who's been on, he said the same thing. He says, what did George Harrison, he says, we sacrificed our nervous systems.
Said that in the Beatle Anthologies.
Yeah.
In the Beatle Anthology TV show movies. Mm-hmm. Yes, he sure said. And, I mean, I have some luxury because I haven't been a road artist or a touring act. And although Keith Richard told me, hey, Sonny, you need to take this on the road once in a while. And I don't know, maybe that's going to happen, but these books started happening.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I go, okay. And I know the books are making an impression. I see, you know, without management, without a publicist, without a website, without being on Facebook, maybe some of that will change. I like watching this thing organically spread. It's sort of like the way in the early 70s we discovered sushi out in Hollywood, or in the 60s Indian foods first started coming to town. I blame Ravi Shankar for bringing Indian food and, you know, George Harrison and Peter Tork for that. But I'm real serious about the work I do, and I think you know that, and I think the books, you know, are a lot of work and a lot of fact-checking and a lot of these are not cut-and-paste jobs, and there's a lot of information that completely will knock your head in because you thought you knew a lot about these recordings, because some of these artists we've seen in three or four different documentaries already. We've read all the liner notes. We've seen them reform. We've seen them on TV shows. We've read about them in print media. We've revisited the records ourselves. And so, therefore, I had to work twice as hard to deliver something that we don't know about, that we've never heard about.
Sure.
Is my friend Dr. James Cushing, a disc jockey on KCPR-FM, he's a doctor in literature and English at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, said to me, the one thing that's really good about your books, and he's quoted in them too, he
mm-hmm.
said, it's not nostalgia if it's new information.
No.
And once,
true.
And I had a, I don't ever say I have mental blocks as a writer. I don't have any of that stuff. But for about 5 minutes a few years ago, he was over and I was talking to him and I said, you know, I really need to strive for new insights and new angles and new data when I do this stuff and not recycle so much of the same story. And he said, you have to keep doing what you're doing because this is not a nostalgia trip if it's new information. And you're not just giving 5, 10, or 15 pieces of information when you read a good book.
Mm-hmm.
You're laying out 150 pieces of new information.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't have to sit here and brag on this stuff.
Nope.
It wouldn't come out if it wasn't as good as I wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I know this is not a recycle trip of the 60s and the 50s.
No.
Because I know that the stuff that has completely influenced all the music made today. I mean, I've had people like Rick Rubin in the book I did, you know, Canyon of Dreams, talk to me about recording the Dixie Chicks, you know, at Sunset Sound, where the Doors and the Buffalo Springfield and people recorded, or using certain mics that used to belong to Donovan or used in Donovan sessions that he used, you know, on some of his Johnny Cash recordings out here. So I know how the blueprints of sound began 40 and 50 years ago in this town. And do I even have to talk to you how many current musicians go out of their way to use vintage gear or vintage equipment or buy vintage, you know, gear and equipment? Well, where do you think the vintage gear and equipment was first used? I mean, aren't they all kind of trying for this sound, this collective sound and pound journey? Don't you think they want to make records that sound like Aftermath recorded at RCA Studios or Good Vibrations done a little bit at Columbia, CBS, or RCA Studios? Or I mean, don't they all have favorite records from this era?
Oh, I have a favorite record from that, one of my favorite records from that era.
Run it on me, man.
Yes. Chapters from the book, Harvey, chapter 18 about the Buffalo Springfield.
Oh, whoa. Yeah. What can I tell you?
Oh, man.
I mean, but I know you told me that was one of your favorite songs, and you, simply as a listener and a fan of the group, and it's an audio recording and a copyright you've heard since 1967, but you never really knew how the song was recorded, where it was recorded. Never got to hear Stan Ross, one of the owners of Gold Star Studios, explain how the tracking was done at Gold Star, and then he kind of helped out a little bit with another engineer when the band took the tapes up to Columbia Studios on Sunset because they had an 8-track machine, and he was involved in helping the song out. So I showed the migration of two studios involved in this epochal recording. And I think this, again, it's not super technical, and we're not talking about, you know, limiters and faders. You know, I don't bring those terms or those tools into this book, but I show the human dynamic of the engineer coaching the musicians that yield the sound that you have loved since 1967. And now you listen to that record differently because I had a few paragraphs about how the drums were recorded or how the mallets weren't used differently. I mean, little things like that I wanted to put in the book. And these come from me doing interviews 10, 20, and 30 years ago with people like Stan Ross, who sadly is not on the planet anymore. Mm-hmm. So I had the, I don't even know what you call it, the ability or the access, let's face it, you know, I'm in L.A.,
right,
to call people up and ask them to tell me about these records. And this is before CD format was even made, or box set reissues and MP3s, and I just wanted to know about the root source of how the sound was captured. And luckily I was allowed to meet Tom Dowd and Stan Ross and Larry Levine and Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler and all these wonderful older rock and roll characters. And I would ask a few questions, sometimes on tape, sometimes visit studios. And, it's been an education for me, and I thought it was time to put some of that education out there in big, huge books. And this zombie that you've just, you're reading. I mean, honestly, I kind of know that when people like you, you know, cite things like the Buffalo Springfield, I gave you some pretty good insights into the band that you thought you knew about, but now you know a lot more about them.
And, you know, I have to say this. For a musician, an engineer, or a record producer, what a pleasure it must be to be interviewed by Harvey Kubernick.
Well, I think that's a thank you for the compliment. I know one thing. They know when I walk in there,
mm-hmm.
I'm not asking about cocaine and chicks
right.
or their previous wife or money and how to get a record deal or hear my demo tape or how can I hustle you. There's not too much of an agenda or a motive.
Yeah.
It's the way Phil Spector was very nice to me to let me come to his sessions in the 70s. He knew I was a student, you know, of the game. I'm very confident in my research skills. I'm a big believer in the oral history format where I let people talk. You see, what has happened is due to media and people having the attention span of gnats these days, I went the other way. I thought I would be the Joseph Campbell warrior hero and do long-form journalism of 10 paragraphs at a time in humongous long interviews with people instead of the usual soundbite society or the quick hit that, you know, the media has kind of crunched things to do in most of the time. And so I give people forum, and it also makes them be responsible to tell me the truth.
Yeah.
And I think I get some really good stuff out of them.
You do, absolutely. And it's kind of the way I feel about the little chats that we have here every Thursday.
Did you get a copy of my Beatles book?
It's fantastic. I haven't had a chance to really get it. It was 50 years ago today the Beatles invade America in Hollywood.
Yeah, you can get that on Amazon. I just kind of thought there's so much done on the Beatles, thousands of books, thousands
yep.
of articles, 50 million TV shows. Why do you want to do a book on the Beatles? And when somebody tells me that, that
yep.
means it's going to happen. You're messing with Harvey Kubernick. But I also know one thing, and not because, you know, I met the four members of the band and interviewed a couple of them, and that I knew that there was a story and a link and a relationship the Beatles always had and still have to the city of L.A. and Hollywood. Not
mm.
because the parent company, kind of Capitol or EMI, was based here and that
yep.
three of the Beatles have homes here. But I knew what kind of music came from L.A. that helped form the Beatles sound. And I also knew the roles, the disc jockeys in this town, like Dave Hull and Dave Diamond and KFWB and KRLA, and George Harrison visiting FM radio stations with advanced copies of the Beatles' White Album. I knew there was a really good story to be told about Los Angeles, Hollywood, the Beatles, the kind of that love triangle between Los Angeles, Hollywood, and the Beatles, not just touring and not just the usual, well, they did a live album from the Hollywood Bowl. No, it's 50 times more deeper than that.
Yeah.
And that's why I asked so many people in the Rascals or in the group Love or in the Monkees and producers like Kim Fowley to tell me about the Beatles. And I assure anybody who loves the band
mm-hmm.
and loves the Beatles, I assure you that if you order this book on Amazon, the Beatles book, you will learn so much about the Beatles and see so many photos and artifacts you've never seen before.
Yeah.
It is like the best $20 or whatever it is to order. Honestly, it's really, and since we are in the middle of the Beatles' 50th year of, you know, coming to America, and by
yep.
the way, July 4th, A Hard Day's Night in a restored DVD
yep.
will be re-released. There's been a few Beatle Fests going on in America, you know, Chicago, Philadelphia, and one is scheduled for October in L.A. and Hollywood. I just think, you know, let's do something on the Beatles, and it was an interesting exercise to take me away from this, you know, the exploration involved in doing this radio book.
Well, Harvey, once again, thank you. Hey, we about have to get out of here. Turn up the radio. It was 50 years ago today, the Beatles invade America in Hollywood. Wonderful show, Harvey. Thank you. Thanks to our listeners around the world. You've been listening to Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest out.